This is CBSI in the World. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague, Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs. Greenland, suddenly it's in the news in Europe. Denmark, who knew, is unhappy that Mr. Trump is saying, we'll buy it. It's Greenland and the Faroe Islands. It's two pieces. It's administered in some fashion by Denmark. I started reading about the administration. In 1930-31, a private mission paid for by private citizens out of London, British explorers, launched the British Arctic Air Expedition of Greenland to explore the plateau above the east coast. They reached the 50 miles from the shore of Greenland and the ice pack, and they had to maneuver their way through ice. They get to Greenland and learn that the Danish ship won a year, didn't get through that year, so everybody's excited to see them. What I take from this is that Denmark has not exactly lavished Greenland with attention for the last 100 years, and therefore the opportunity to buy it seems well-spoken, especially because my understanding, Gregory, this isn't just about resources. This is also about the defense of North America from what used to be called the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap for deploying Russian naval assets out of the Northern Fleet. That is not covered until the U.S. Navy covers it. Also, the Arctic Ocean is opening, we're told, over the next 100 years, and it cuts down the travel time from Asia to Europe and vice versa. Therefore, having a military and economic presence in the Arctic is vital to the success of any state. Russia has one, China wants one, and Greenland is well positioned as the world's largest non-continental island. What's wrong with this picture, Gregory? Why doesn't Denmark jump at the deal? It's a right now, Faroe Islands and Greenland are a burden to their budget, and make the deal. Was this more reacting to Trump rather than listening to him?
No, but let's first state that Greenland and the Panama Canal and Panama itself are incredibly important to U.S. security, and to relinquish access to those, as Jimmy Carter did with Panama, it was profoundly damaging to U.S. strategic
positioning. And Ronald Reagan said it at the time. I remember the presentation he made on Bill Buckley's show. Firing line.
Yeah.
He was very articulate about, don't do this. Please continue.
Yep. So there's nothing wrong with saying that these are vital to the United States security and economy, perhaps even more so today than when Jimmy Carter gratuitously gave away what the American taxpayers had paid for. But with the case of Greenland, dominating the Arctic is critical for resources, but also for access and for the polar control of access to satellites and spacecraft in a polar orbit, particularly things like the fractional orbital bombardment system and the like, which relies on a polar orbit to deliver hypersonic weapons to targets around the world. So controlling Greenland would be critical for the United States, and not so much to stop the Russians from doing it, but to stop the Chinese from doing it. Now, if you wanted to really buy Greenland, I think the way to go about it wouldn't be not to offend the Danish polity at all, and the King of Denmark. It, in fact, so offended the Danes that the U.S. would be so coarse as to say we're going to buy it from you, that the King changed his coat of arms to place the arms of Greenland and the Faroe Islands into greater prominence within the King's arms, to say, no, we this is us, and this is where we intend to stay, and they have every right to do that. These are territories of Greenland. Even today, even though the United States was able to purchase Alaska from Russia in the late 1800s, if the United States was told by Beijing today, well, we're going to buy Alaska from you, there would be massive indignation among the U.S. population, and rightly so. The question is, what does President Trump want to do? Certainly, the U.S. has always had good base access to Greenland whenever it's been needed.
75 military personnel now, I read. So it's a small group.
Yeah. Yeah, and the number of military personnel is not going to be the key indicator, but there's certainly room for the expansion of U.S. presence there, as occurred during World War II and the like. And it would be a great benefit to the United Kingdom, still traditionally, apart from the current government, a great ally of the United States. But going about it the way that was suggested had the same effect as it had when the first time President Trump announced it for Greenland. It was regarded as offensive and coarse and was rejected out of hand. The question is, how do you treat an ally like Denmark? Because Denmark has been an ally of the United States. It has fought on the front lines of wars and was occupied by the Nazis in World War II and the like. So, yes, you could do it. Secondly, how would you wish to do it in a way which enhances the U.S. international prestige around the world rather than detracting from it? Right now, President Trump is going to have to build up the prestige and coercive, soft coercive capability of the United States through being respected and needed by the other states in the world. Right now, much of the world thinks that maybe this is the time when we don't need the United States as much as we did 30 or 40 years ago. So that's a factor. I do think that that President Trump wants to start his term in office, his new term in office, with some meaningful announcements. And I believe that these earlier statements will serve as a distraction from getting through on day one a number of the announcements he's going to make. I think there's already, we know, discussions going on between the colonial administration or the regional administration in Greenland with President Trump's son and the like. So, okay, they're doing something there.
About Panama, I want to tuck Panama in. Panama's history is complicated by the decision by TR to stage a theatrical revolution, one version that transferred Colombia to the Panama Canal Zone. That was more than 100 years ago. The U.S. built the canal, clearly. However, in the treaty that was signed in the Carter administration and finally acted upon during the Clinton administration, the end of the century, the U.S. provides defense of Panama. So I have read repeatedly that the defense is not going well because China's Costco, which is a Chinese Communist Party cutout, owns both ends of the canal and is ready to invest more in it. That's not defending the canal from our adversary, the People's Republic of China. That would suggest that the Mulino government in Panama City is not adequate to the challenge.
Well, I think that they have based another couple of decades of neglect after the Carter decision. The management of the canal went immediately to the Hutchison Whampoa Company, which is a Hong Kong company, quite apart from the Costco control of the ports at either end. And the United States did nothing about it, didn't invest really in the necessary maintenance and expansion of the canal, and that showed with this past year's drought, which made the canal temporarily less than capable. So the question is, does the U.S. go back in and try to renegotiate a position with the Panamanian government, including helping to strengthen the Panamanian government so that it can be independent of Beijing, although that may be impossible. It may have to wait until the Panamanian elections change the government. But the reality is that there are other options now for the U.S. which should have been pursued over recent years, including other canal proposals across the isthmus or the canals and rail and road links across Mexico and the like. So ideal situation, yes, get the U.S. back in control of the old Panama Canal zone, which would require real cooperation with the government of Panama, and literally reposition the Panama Canal as a U.S. strategic asset with U.S. force presence. That would start to reassert the United States into the Caribbean Basin and South America in a way which it hasn't done for decades. That would be helpful. Are we going about it the right way? debatable. The comments certainly scared Beijing and scared Panama City. So maybe that will be the start, if you like, the wolf warrior start to a negotiating position with the Panamanian government. But it certainly has given Beijing time to come up with counterarguments to sway the government of Panama in the meantime.
Let's go to your coverage of the Chengdu aircraft revealed recently by the People's Republic of China. In case there's doubts about who's an adversary, this, as I understand, is a long-range strike aircraft looking like a flying saucer, stealthed up. It's meant to penetrate the first island chain, the second island chain. Is a carrier killer, a Guam killer, to carry strike missiles, hypersonic, I believe. But in any event, it is extremely hostile-looking aircraft. The question I have is, does it work? The Chinese do tend to build things that don't work as well as the original model they stole. How about this one?
Well, this one they didn't steal, which is the interesting thing. And it's got a three-engine configuration, which, again, is interesting. Part of that may be that the Chinese aero engine industry is not as advanced as it should be to power up a concept like this new Chengdu J-36, as it's being tentatively called. But the reality is that they have a very interesting aircraft which has a low radar signature, capable of going long distances at supercruise. In other words, it can go... when I say supercruise, that means it can get to its cruising altitude and go to Mach 1.5 or so.
At 60,000 feet, it's very impressive if they can do that. Very impressive.
Without using afterburners, that's the key. However, it's because of its configuration, you know that it's a long-range attack aircraft able to deliver long-range standoff weapons. So in other words, you've got a long range and then you've got additional range for your standoff weapons. It doesn't have a vertical tail surface, so that that lowers its radar signature. But however, at height and speed, it will have a strong infrared signature from the heat generating around the nose cone of the aircraft. So it's going to have its vulnerabilities, but on the whole, it does the job for China, which the B-21 will do against China by the U.S. Air Force, and at a much lower cost, it would appear. The question is, when would such an aircraft as this new Chengdu model become available? It's possible they could get operational capability within 4 years for this, and that would be significant. But it's certainly not an invincible aircraft, and high-altitude aircraft and hypersonic missiles are still vulnerable to solid air defenses, which are being built against ballistic missiles. The same concept that we've been seeing in Israel with the tiered defense against ballistic missiles, which tend to be hypersonic if they're coming down from space. So you've got the Arrow 3 program in Israel, and the U.S. is developing a version of that. You've got the Sling project for the middle level air defense, and then you've got Iron Dome at the lower level. So clearly, the defenses against these kind of weapons are emerging, but it's very interesting to see that the PRC, which is not able to support feeding its population at this stage, we're getting back to the whole Maoist era of the 1950s and early 60s, where the economy of the country is in a shambles, but they're throwing money at the development of their weapon systems. Whether they can also build an esprit de corps and a capability within the People's Liberation Army is another matter again, but this is an impressive aircraft, this new Chengdu, big diamond-shaped wing plan it going forward. They've done something fairly significant here, which will require thinking about within the West. They've also launched a new short-range advanced maybe a sixth generation fighter. But again, I think they're going to have problems with their engines. Right now, most of their advanced combat aircraft use engines which have a lifespan of about 200 flying hours. And that means that would be used up very, very quickly right. within a combat situation.
Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs, just establishing the assertion that China is an adversary, not an ally. There's been some mix-up of that over the years. We're going to turn to our favorite moment of the week, the King Charles Report. We have good news.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.